41238, in re Amy Unknown. Ms. Kenner? Oh, no, Mr. Cassell, excuse me.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Paul Cassell from the University of Utah and James Marsh from White Plains, New York, here today on behalf of Amy. Amy asked this court to protect her right to restitution. The Crime Victims' Rights Act promises her a right to full and timely restitution as provided in law. And the applicable law here is Section 2259, which makes restitution mandatory for offenses of this type. Now, in the district court, she made a proper application for restitution and presented compelling evidence that she's going to have a lifetime of counseling expenses and lost income as a result of fear. That fear comes from the fact that somebody might Google her name and then an image could pop up showing her being sexually abused. That fear can come from walking down the street and seeing a man smiling at her and having to wonder, is that man smiling because he's comparing how I look today with how I looked long ago? She lives in fear that somebody's going to invade her most basic right to privacy by looking at images of her being raped when she was an 8-year-old girl. One of those somebodies that she has to fear, one of those anonymous somebodies, is Mr. Paroline, the defendant in this case, who's pled guilty to possessing two of her images. The district court said that that possession had in fact harmed Amy. There's no dispute about that. That hasn't been appealed by the other side. So this case comes to the court with a finding that there has been harm to Amy. The only issue is a legal issue. The district court said, well, she failed to show proximate cause to the losses that she suffered.
Well, why don't you start off with jurisdiction?
All right. Jurisdiction is proper to review that legal conclusion, which is subject to an over-review, of course, under Section 1291. Section 1291 gives this court broad power to review all final decisions of the district court.
But you're not a party to the underlying criminal action.
That's correct. We filed in the district court appropriate restitution order, and we're now seeking to use review of the as a non-party. Yeah.
Mr. Cassell, somehow you got to get through, what is it, 3771D that gives your client certain enforcement actions.
Yes.
One of which, obviously, is the writ of mandamus.
Yes.
And then specifically gives the government the right to assert any error.
D4 gives
to
the government
defend,
a right.
To defend the victim's right. I was wanting to make sure that
right.
that victim right part was there. Now, how do you get around the statute? I mean, this is a complex statute. There's problems. Now, how do you help us to get around all these hurdles?
Well, we're not asking you to get around the statute. We're simply asking you to give that statute a harmonizing reading. There are two statutes here, 1291, the General Appeal Statute, and 3771, the Crime Victims' Rights Act.
Now, 1291 is only subject matter jurisdiction. That doesn't give you the right to come up here.
That's right.
It gives the subject matter, it allows us the subject matter jurisdiction to hear it.
Right. And then you would look to this court's jurisprudence on non-party appeal rights, SEC versus Forex Asset Management Company. We agree that that's controlling precedent. And interestingly, we've cited that in every single one of our briefs for the last 11 months. It's controlling Fifth Circuit law on non-party appeals, and the other side has yet to explain how we do not meet the three prongs of that standard.
Well, I think the problem in that area is that the fairly well-reasoned decision of the two of them of the Tenth Circuit point out that when Congress used the term mandamus, it used it in conjunction with the next subsection that gives the government the right to appeal.
It doesn't say the government has the right to appeal. What it says is the government has the right to assert error in the appeal. So that would be a defensive situation where there is a defendant appeal. The government then has the right to assert error.
I guess you could say that some would have said under the VWPA it couldn't. You think? I mean,
right,
how do
exactly.
you juxtapose? What's the point of juxtapose? Why did Congress pass a law with those two provisions in that order?
Right. Well, just a couple of thoughts on that. One is that the Crime Victims' Rights Act is designed to expand the rights of victims. And that's quite clear from the legislative history, quite clear from the structure. And so the question would be, was there a pre-existing right of victims to appeal under 1291? If so, the Crime Victims' Rights Act would not impliedly restrict those rights if they existed previously. We would direct the court's attention to the Third Circuit case, United States versus Konitz, a 1996 decision with government support in which the victim was able to appeal a restitution award. Now, if the other side's position on interpreting those statutes is correct, what happened in 2004 when the Crime Victims' Rights Act was enacted, then all victims in the Third Circuit immediately had their rights to appeal stripped away, and they could only proceed through a mandamus procedure. That would be contrary to the direct legislative history of the Crime Victims' Rights Act. Senator Kyle said, this act is designed not to limit in any way pre-existing rights of victims found in case law.
See, what you seem to be arguing, and this is the question that I have, and I don't know if the legislative history in this case supports that, but it's almost like a CERCLA-type action. That is to say, if you find that a person possessed land and contributed to the environmental pollution in any way, then that person is liable 100% with contributory actions afterwards. Now, I do note that I think it's 18 U.S.C., what is it, 3664 H or D, whatever, allows that type of contribution normally. But how do you square all of that with this structure? I mean, it may be that the remedy is not with us, but with Congress. And that's, do you understand? I mean, this is...
I understand the question very much, Judge Garza. Let me explain how we see the statutory landscape unfolding. Remember that in most circuits, right now a majority of circuits, crime victims can take a mandamus review action and get full appellate review of whether a district judge made an erroneous legal conclusion.
Well, it's in three circuits, right?
And one unpublished decision. The Third Circuit makes it four. Three and a half, maybe then. So when those other circuits to come...
You need to speak in the microphone.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, just pull that real
quick. I'm sorry. So when those other circuits right now, 2nd, 9th, 3rd, and 11th, a crime victim can get full review of a legal decision by the district judge, such as the one here, whether there's proximate cause. Now, in the 5th Circuit, we can only get clear and indisputable error review, which is very difficult to approve in an evolving area of law. But what we submit, the way the statute should be read is this. If you want a quick, down and dirty, clear and indisputable error review, you can file your mandamus action. If you want to file a more leisurely, orderly, full-blown review of the legal conclusions, you proceed by way of appellate action. And that's, of course, the right that you would have in the Third Circuit under United States versus Konitz. You'd have that right in the Sixth Circuit in United States versus Perry, a very detailed decision. A decision, by the way, you mentioned the Hunter decision. The Tenth Circuit didn't know about the Perry decision when it ruled. It said, we're unaware of any authority out there allowing a victim to appeal after judgment. In fact, there were two such cases, the Konitz decision from the Third Circuit and the Perry decision from the Sixth Circuit. That becomes very significant because the Tenth Circuit's construction of the CVRA, if it's correct, would impliedly strip thousands of victims in the Third Circuit of their right to appeal restitution orders, thousands of victims in the Sixth Circuit of their right to appeal crime victim judgment issues, which was the issue in Perry.
Perry had a long dissent, though, as far as that goes.
Right. The majority opinion, in our view, is much more carefully reasoned. And certainly in any event, the key question becomes how to construe the Crime Victims' Rights Act in October of 2004. If the Tenth Circuit is correct that that blocks victims' rights to appeal, then all the victims in the Sixth Circuit that had rights under Perry to take appeals lost those rights when the Crime Victims' Rights Act was enacted. That cannot be the proper construction of the Crime Victims' Rights Act. As the title suggests, the structure suggests, the legislative history suggests, it was designed to expand the rights of crime victims. And what the Tenth Circuit has done is stood the act on its head. It said, well, when this law came in and passed a mandamus procedure, that stripped away other rights that victims would have had to proceed by way of appeal. And there are other cases as well where victims have been able to take appeals. In Re Doe, the Fourth Circuit case.
If this was supposed, you know, you say the Crime Victims Recovery Act was supposed to expand rights.
Yes.
But it cannot expand rights any more than the statute allows.
Right.
The act itself allows. And that to me is still, we get thrown back to D3 and D4 and the juxtaposition of those two subsections, which at least implicitly denies your client the right to assert error, though it does give your client the right to assert a mandamus.
Correct, except to this point. I'm sorry, not correct. It does say that the government, let's look at the language very specifically, because I think the plain language is critical here. It says, in any appeal in a criminal case, the government may assert as error the district court's denial of a crime victim's right in the proceeding to which the appeal relates.
Right.
That's designed to create a body of case law. We know that most appeals in criminal cases are taken by defendants, and the government can then automatically assert error and start to create a body of case law.
Well, and wasn't it true that this was responsive to decisions under the MVRA and the VWPA, was it not? Because here, when this statute is giving the victim a certain statutory standing, it could be argued that only the victim should be able to appeal and not the government instead of the victim, and therefore they were thinking, well, we're going to make it clear that the government can appeal even though the victim also has standing.
There is another, that's exactly right. That's, again, another harmonizing reading that would explain why both the government can assert defensive error in a defense appeal, but the victim is nonetheless allowed to appeal. I mean, this would be the construction that's being suggested by the government is a very curious one. Amy says that she's entitled to $3.3 million in restitution. She lost on a legal judgment below.
What I don't understand is why the government has switched sides. They were on Amy's side in the trial court, were they not?
Right.
I'm not sure how they can switch sides now and say that the statute doesn't entitle her to relief. That seems very, if not duplicitous, very strange to me.
Well, and there's
also in derogation of the obvious intent of that provision of the statute.
Well, and there's another provision that requires the government to use its best efforts to defend the rights of victims. And so what the government is saying is, if we decide to abandon you on appeal, not file a one-sentence notice of appeal, you lose $3.3 million in restitution to which you are mandatorily entitled, simply because we didn't file that piece of the paper, because we'll go up to the Fifth Circuit and say, oh, look, you don't have any right to go there.
Well, now, there may be some feeling of discomfort with the idea about the proximate cause test and all that. I suppose the district court had awarded $50,000 instead of $3.5. Would you still be appealing or attempting to?
Perhaps not. We would have to make a judgment with our client on that.
Certainly within the wide discretion, it seems to me, but
we've gotten substantial awards in a number of cases, and given we'd have to make an assessment.
You can't make a judgment with your client, can you? Because you don't tell your client anything.
Well, we keep in touch with our client generally on the nature of the litigation and but as to day-to-day tactical.
So that she was not told about any of this.
Well, she's told about the general nature of the litigation, but she's not told this man, Mr. Paroline, looked at this image of you being attacked. We don't get down to that level of specificity, obviously, because that would re-traumatize her. But she is kept fully informed of the nature of the litigation and, of course, recoveries that we make for her around the country.
If the go ahead.
Maybe I should, I see my time is starting to draw to a close. I wonder if I should just attend briefly to the merits of the decision, unless there are additional questions about the jurisdictional issues.
We'll give you a few more, we'll give you three more minutes.
All right. Let me turn then to the merits, and this is a legal issue for which review would be de novo. There are six lettered subsections in the statute, A through F. Only subsection F has the proximate harm requirement. The district judge read that requirement from subsection F back through the other five. That's not what the plain language of the statute says. The statute could easily have been written with a proximate harm requirement that would have gone all the way through it. In addition, the very first words of the statute begin, notwithstanding section 3663, the Victim Witness Protection Act. That's the very first words in this provision. That makes it quite clear that Congress intended for this mandatory restitution provision to be interpreted notwithstanding the Victim Witness Protection Act, which has a direct and proximate harm requirement. Another point to be made is that the district judge said, well, look, if you have this proximate harm requirement, then Amy can't sort out who is victimizing her and who's not. It makes the statute largely unworkable, was the term that the district court used. We propose an interpretation that will make the statute workable. As between two interpretations, one that the district court admits makes the statute unworkable, and the one that we propose, which makes it quite workable, obviously this court should prefer the workable interpretation. The plain language of the restitution provision says that a victim is entitled to recovery for the full amount of the victim's losses, and it makes restitution mandatory. Again, we don't have to guess about intent here. We know specifically from the wording of the statute that it doesn't say
that it's entitled to the full full restitution from that individual for all of the losses that someone else has caused.
It says, for the purposes of this subsection, the term full amount of the victim's losses includes various things. And then it goes on to define who would be harmed by a statute, harmed by a crime. The basic question is this. Who's going to have to run around the country trying to apportion out the damages? Is Amy going to have to run around to every single district? Or should Mr. Paroline, the guilty criminal, if he's upset about paying $3.3 million, he can file offset actions against these other defendants and he can work it out. Obviously, you can make policy arguments in favor of either construction of the statute. But Congress has clearly chosen a statute that was designed to give broad recovery to victims. They wanted to give, and again, the words here are the full amount of the victim's losses in restitution to the people like Amy.
The government did furnish a summary of Amy's other restitution actions, and some of those had resulted in no recovery.
Yes.
Have there been appeals in any of those other cases?
There are appeals pending in several of those cases. The one thing we would point out, there are three Court of Appeals decisions that talk about approximate harm requirement. They're cited by the other side.
Crandon,
Searle, and Laney. I would ask the court to be aware of the fact that in all three of those cases, there was never an adversarial posture. There was not a victim's advocate there saying, wait a minute, it doesn't impose approximate.
The language of the statute also says that the predicate to describing that the victim is entitled to recover all losses suffered as a result of the conduct around the, it's not the offense conduct, but the conduct constituting the harm or something like that.
That's
an
only
individual harmed as a result of the commission of a crime under this chapter.
Right, that's subsection F, which we're not relying on here. We're relying on subsection A.
This is subsection C of 2259.
I'm sorry. As a result of the commission of the crime, right.
And that could be interpreted to mean the commission of this particular crime.
No, that's not. Oh, I had a different point.
Well, a couple of thoughts, Your Honor. First of all, there's a finding of fact here that Amy satisfies that requirement. And the other side is not cross-appealed. The district court found that she was, in fact, harmed by Paroline's possession of the materials in question. That makes her a victim. So subsection C has been satisfied. That's what the district court found. The other side is not cross-appealed on that issue.
Does that mean that there would be, by necessity, some damage?
Yes. And in fact, the district court found that as well. He said there's some damage, but you haven't told me whether it's 1% or 10%, so you're out of luck. You get $0, you get no compensation, no restitution whatsoever, because you can't prove with a mathematical certainty what's going on here. That's obviously contrary to the intent of what Congress wanted. Judge Dennis reached.
Okay, but what is the strategy of the defendant in this case to seek all or nothing? Why would she not have said, I suffered $100,000 worth of damage as a result of this particular depiction?
The problem is she can't disentangle it. Let me give you the classic law school hypothetical or example that I think fits this case perfectly. There are 10 polluters that all dump toxic materials into a river, and somebody downstream drinks it and gets cancer. You can't prove which of the 10 was responsible, but we know under common tort law principles, all 10 are jointly and severally liable. That's exactly what we have here.
Not really here, because she would suffer a new injury every time she was depicted. And this depiction would be constitute a new and separable injury, would it not?
Well, it would constitute a new injury, but an injury that you can't disentangle from all the other injuries. So next Tuesday, she goes to counseling. Is that because Paroline looked at her image last week?
It's one thing if one peeping Tom has seen you through the window and you have to confront that person in court. It's another time if you literally do not know how many thousands of men have looked at your image.
And the record is clear. Her psychologist has explained. That's what makes this so insidious. That's why I started my presentation by explaining why she has these lifetime damages. She never knows who's looking at it or when it's happening.
But just in terms of a strategy to actually recover money from her, doesn't it make sense to try to limit the demand for recovery here?
No, because that forces her. If she asks for, let's say, $1,000 here, that forces her.
She asked for $100,000. I mean, she can say, I mean, along the lines of what Judge Jones has suggested, I'm going to be seen by 100,000 people as a result of this particular depiction of this particular crime, and therefore, I mean, this contributes a substantial injury to me of $100,000.
Two things on that. First, Congress promised her that she would get, quote, the full amount of her losses. So she is entitled to assert that. But secondly, the strategy you're proposing would commit her to 33 district courts around the country.
Nobody can afford to litigate. I mean, then you'd have to litigate every single one over and over and over again.
She'd have to go to 33 district courts. And by the way, then she'd have to get
dollars in a pocket. She ain't got a thing in a pocket now.
Well, we hope to get a favorable ruling from this court, and then she'll have a $3.3 million judgment, and she can begin trying to collect it. The other problem you have on this, if she were to limit herself to $100,000, she never knows whether the defendant has money in his pocket or not. She's hoping, obviously, to find the occasional defendant who can satisfy the full $3.3 million, and if she can find one of those cases, then she's done. This actually protects the interests of defendants because they can then get the whatever offset they need.
She's got her judgment, and it's joint. And severally liable, and so she, among all of the people that have depicted her, she can find a deep pocket somewhere.
Correct. Somebody who can make her whole for the injuries that she suffered. And then she's done. She doesn't have to spend her time litigating anymore.
Mr. Cassell, I presume that there is absolutely no way of determining how many people have seen her image.
It's thousands.
I mean, but there is no way of determining that.
You can. The internet monitors can watch and determine when there are technological ways.
How many hits?
How many hits have come onto a particular site or things like that? And we know it's in the thousands, but we don't. We know that there have been. You've already seen the list. We know that there are currently pending something like 55 cases involving Amy's image. And again, that's what makes this. Somebody might look at this and say $3.3 million. This is a Texas tort lawyer dreaming this up. This is a fact that she's going to have to deal with for the rest of her life. She never knows who's looking at her image.
Congress was well aware of that when they tried to increase the cost of viewing child pornography. That was precisely their intent. However, unless my colleagues have questions, I think we ought to give you some time for rebuttal. And I would like you to address the impact of that $150,000 provision on the civil damage side when you get up.
I will.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Kinner. You're going to have to pull the mic over a little closer, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. Is that better?
Yes,
for me. May it please the court, counsel. Your Honor, we are in the unusual position of sharing time with the defendant, Mr. Paroline. For the efficiency of the argument, I will address the non-party appellate issue, and Mr. Paroline's counsel, Mr. Files, will address.
Can you pull that closer, even?
Just move it sideways.
Mr. Paroline's counsel, Mr. Files, will address the district court's order denying restitution to Amy. Before I go into the substance of my argument, though, I would like to address the concern expressed by Judge Jones, Chief Judge Jones, that the government has switched sides in this case. We do not consider ourselves adverse to Amy's interest. I know it may appear that way. But we do not consider, we supported her request for restitution below. We gave what we believed our best efforts were to help her obtain that restitution. However, the Department of Justice is in a unique position from the parties to a lawsuit. Our interests are different from both Amy's and from Mr. Paroline's, in that we also are bound to consider presenting the law correctly to the court. That's why, after much consideration in our office, we determined that we did need to oppose the petition for writ of mandamus on the grounds that the error was not clear or indisputable. Likewise, in this case, we are here to support what we believe the law is. with respect to non-party appeals.
Well, let me ask you a question about clear and indisputable. If we used a different, and I'm not, I'll get to Mr. Files about the merits later, but if we were to use a different test, the test used by the other circuits, just a de novo review test, would you then argue that the district court was wrong?
Your Honor, I believe the Ninth and the Second Circuit are using abuse of discretion for these petitions of writ of mandamus. And the 11th, it's hard to discern what they did approach a de novo review. Although it is hard, they didn't actually articulate what standard they were using.
Well, I'm still asking you a direct question, though. If we were to review the, we hold that error of law constitutes an abuse of discretion in most of our interlocutory review standards. Therefore, is it not the case, wouldn't the government have to agree that as a matter of de novo interpretation of this statute, the district court was wrong?
Not entirely, Your Honor.
Then you're not on Amy's side.
Well, may I explain a touch further? We argued to the district court that there was a proximate causation requirement. We thought we had made that factually. We thought we had demonstrated proximate causation that would justify an award of restitution. We believed that Amy was also arguing to the district court that there was a proximate causation requirement. And I think there are portions of the record when you review the two different restitution hearings that support that. So we thought we were in agreement on the law. The way we digressed from the district court, we disagreed with the district court on the factual nature of the findings. Although the stipulation that was entered by Amy and us and Mr. Paroline did make that factual call different in this case, and it does make it different from the other cases in which he didn't enter a stipulation regarding the proximate causation. So that put this case in a slightly different factual posture from most of the other Amy cases throughout the nation. But I think we would have argued to this court, even under a de novo review, that there is a proximate causation requirement. That was our position below. We thought we were in agreement with Amy on that.
I didn't understand what you said when you said that this makes it different from all other cases in the country?
Well, in most of the cases, Amy did not enter a stipulation regarding the defendant's viewing of the images, the losses flowing from that view. The stipulation is in our brief, and of course it's part of the record.
Okay.
And that does put this case in a slightly different factual posture. I believe there is one other case in the country where Amy has entered a stipulation. I think it is somewhat similar to the stipulation. I believe Mr. Files will address that.
So the stipulation was for proximate cause?
The stipulation didn't exactly use, I will read it to the court. What the stipulation said was that any and all notices required to be sent by the government to Amy were received by Mr. James R. Marsh, Amy's representative. Mr. Marsh did not pass on any of these notices to Amy or inform her that he had received them. Amy does not know who Doyle Randall Paroline is, and none of the damages for which Amy is now seeking restitution flow from anyone telling her specifically about Mr. Paroline or telling her about his conduct, which was the basis for the prosecution in this case. When one looks at the proximate cause,
is that a numbered stipulation?
Is that a numbered stipulation? It is found in the record at USCA 5325.
5335? 325. Ms. Kenner, your voice is trailing, and if there's any way of getting that microphone closer to you, that would be much, much better. When you're reading this way, your voice is not being picked up.
And I do apologize, this honor.
It's very hard for you. I understand.
It's okay.
Well, I know the court does have lapel mics. they were unavailable because some of the work that's been going on in the courtroom, apparently. We asked about it this morning. So I do apologize. I will try to keep pointing this way. Turning to the issue of non-party appeals. Today we urge the court to join the 10th and the 1st Circuits in holding that the victims under the CVRA may not file a direct appeal from a denial of their rights under the CVRA, but rather that their exclusive remedy is a petition for writ of mandamus.
Well, really it's only the 10th Circuit that goes with that view, right? Explicitly. I mean, the other circuits, that's why I question whether the government is supporting Amy or not, because she's in an untenable position here legally, in that, as you know, the 5th Circuit has applied a narrow standard to mandamus, as has the 10th, and the courts that have allowed mandamus review have said that it's under a different standard, a less demanding standard.
Is there a distinction here? This type of mandamus, generally speaking, you do not mandamus an order like this that is part of a final judgment. Generally speaking, it's something else, discovery or something else. Does it make sense that if you are correct, that the only avenue is a mandamus, that the standard should be lowered, that is to say, for an abuse of discretion?
They're not saying that.
I know you're not, but I mean, what's your argument against that?
Your Honor, that goes back to, for this panel is bound by N. Ray Dean. I understand conceptually what the court is asking. Would it make more sense to apply, say, an abuse of discretion standard?
Sure.
And the 9th and the 2nd Circuit clearly have said that. The 11th is harder to tell. Now, this court, of course, is bound by N. Ray Dean, and it did so on the basis of using the same reasoning that the 10th Circuit did, that when Congress used the term mandamus, that was a term that is defined in the law, and they meant it, and they applied it to all the rights. They didn't differentiate out among the rights that are listed in the Crime Victim Rights Act. So when Congress used mandamus, it meant mandamus, as mandamus has traditionally been applied.
But
they could have said direct appeal.
But mandamus as a standard of review for us has been interpreted differently by different courts. The question then is, what did the Congress intend for that standard to be? Should it be the more relaxed abuse of discretion standard or the more strict standard that we use in the circuit here?
And this court in N. Ray Dean has addressed that question under the Crime Victim Rights Act and determined that this court would use the stricter standard that it traditionally applies to mandamus. And this court is bound, this panel is bound by its prior decision, or by the court's prior decision, and if it wanted to reconsider that, would be appropriate for en banc review. Your Honor, I see that that the red light has gone on.
You can go. We have some more questions.
Yes, I do want to address briefly your question, Chief Judge Jones, about the First Circuit's case. In Aguirre-Gonzalez, the court did find that mandamus was the exclusive review. I don't know whether they addressed the actual how they were going to consider mandamus, and they're not one of the ones that have made the decision yet.
Why don't you? I don't think the government addressed their arguments about the Perry or the Conis cases.
Yes, Your Honor, and I would like to. The Conis. I'll take the Conis case first. Conis is a 1996 case out of the Third Circuit. The brief was unavailable on Westlaw, so I called the assistant United States attorney who wrote the brief, who happens to still be working for the United States Attorney's Office. He does have a recollection of the case, and the government's failure to assert a bar on non-party appeals was inadvertent.
Well, the defendant didn't raise it either, and it's unexplained, but they said we have jurisdiction. And then the Perry case has a debate about it and, you know, present both sides of the issue, and the answer and the disposition is very clear.
Yeah, in the Perry case, it is in a slightly different posture, and I think it must be read in conjunction with the Acker case, which we filed in a supplemental case, because that's also from the Sixth Circuit. Interestingly, Judge Clay, who authored Perry, was on the panel in the Acker case, which is, I believe, a 2010 case. Acker actually assesses a situation very similar to the one that the court is now is faced with. You have crime victims asserting their rights under the CVRA.
But that's not the point at all. The point that he made is that Congress, you have these competing canons of interpretation. Congress is presumed to legislate against the backdrop of known standards of appellate procedure, and therefore you had two circuit court cases that held that victims had the right to appeal.
I don't think that Perry applies in this context, Your Honor. In Perry, you have the court found was a property interest created by a judgment lien under the MVPR, under the Mandatory Victim Restitution Act. The court, in considering it, evaluated it first under a civil review. They allowed the time frame for filing a civil notice appeal. They considered it to be a civil-type case and, in fact, said this is not an ordinary appeal in a criminal case. That is part of Perry. They do leave the door open. Within Perry, the court says, well, irrespective of whether a victim can appeal a restitution order, the victim can appeal a judgment lien created by a restitution order, or the dissolution of a judgment lien created by a restitution order. So it's not entirely on point with the facts of this case. I think the Sixth Circuit's later decision in Acker is actually closer to being on point with this case.
Do they distinguish or refer to Perry?
They don't refer to Perry at all.
Well, that's their problem.
Yeah, well, but I think it is significant that Judge Clay was on both panels. Judge Clay, from the Sixth Circuit, wrote Perry, and then he was on the panel in Acker, and they don't even mention Perry in Acker.
All right, well, that's... There's also the possibility that this court could take jurisdiction over the case as a matter of rehearing of the mandamus decision.
Exactly, Your Honor.
So you don't disagree with that?
We have looked at the case law on this. Rule 40 seems to anticipate that a petition for rehearing will be heard by the panel that heard the case.
Well, the panel consolidated. I mean, the panel opted. It's a very unusual situation, but the panel opted to move that along with the direct appeal for further disposition. So, and I guess you're aware, aren't you, that in the Antrobus case, the Tenth Circuit did, in fact, issue an order on rehearing.
I understand that, Your Honor, and the government is not going to challenge the consolidation. We didn't oppose it.
Right.
And we are not going to argue that this court cannot consider the petition for panel rehearing. We would, if the court does intend to it, we have not been asked to respond, and the government would like to respond if the court so orders.
All right. Thank you. Okay, Mr. Files. Is that all right?
May it please the court, I'm F.R. Files, Jr. I'm a lawyer from Tyler, Texas, joined by Stanley Snyder, a lawyer from Houston, and representing Mr. Paroline. Your Honor, the court asked whether or not there were any appeals from judgments that gave zero restitution to a victim in these cases. There are at least seven Vicki or AB series opinions. We'll file a Rule 28 letter for the court.
Well, the fact that they're pending doesn't matter. We would need to be advised if any of them get decided.
They have been decided, Your Honor.
Oh.
We've got those, and there's one for
Well, you just furnish them to the court afterwards.
We shall, Your Honor.
Going to rely on them or something.
I only want to spend one moment on what the court has been talking about earlier, and that is the mandamus versus appeal. And I think it is important to look at Judge Kyle's statement on October 9th, 2004 in the congressional record having to do with section D3. Quoting him, this subsection provides that a crime victim who is denied of his or her rights as a crime victim has standing to seek appellate review of that denial. Specifically, the provision allows a crime victim to apply for a writ of mandamus to the appropriate appellate court. So without regard to what the standard of review is, it appears that that is the clear congressional intent. If it were otherwise, then a victim would have a right to mandamus and also appeal, which the government never has and the defense never has. So it's illogical that there is more than one right, and that would be the right to mandamus. I'd like to jump in to begin with.
Is the right to mandamus and appeal the same decision?
Yeah, you can't have two bites at the apple on the same decision.
That's what I'm saying.
Yes, sir. Yes, Your Honor.
Usually, I mean, people have the right to mandamus and the right to appeal, but not the same decision.
Yes, sir. Judge Davis did a great job of pinning the lawyers down on what the lawyers' positions were at the hearings. Judge Davis asks four specific questions of Mr. Marsh. And their position now is that there shouldn't be a causal connection, shouldn't be a proximate cause requirement. But in the court, in the transcript, we find these questions from Judge Davis. So, Mr. Marsh, are you saying that other than paragraph F, the statute does have a causation requirement? And if so, what type of requirement? Or does that not have any causation requirement at all? Mr. Marsh's response. Your Honor, it would be folly for me to argue that we did not have to show harm caused by the commission of this crime. Clearly, it is not strict liability. Skipping down, we clearly have to show harm by the commission of the crime, and I think we have established harm by the commission of the crime.
Were they seeking $3 million at that time?
Yes, Your Honor, they were.
And were they seeking the harm for all injuries done to her from the inception at 9 years old?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's covered by the next questions.
Okay.
Your Honor, when you say require harm caused by the commission of this crime, by this crime you were referring to the possession, to his possession of two photographs.
Have you ever represented a plaintiff in court?
Ma'am?
You've represented plaintiffs in court, haven't you?
No, ma'am, I have not.
All right, well, good. But let me just, from my broad wealth of experience, the plaintiff never goes in asking for the least possible amount of money. The plaintiff goes into court asking the jury or the judge for the greatest possible amount of money, and then it's up to the jury or judge to determine based on the strength of the evidence.
I understand.
Now, well, and you're, you know, if you're trying to make an argument that they've waived or pleaded themselves out of court, that's not acceptable in this context, it seems to me.
I'm not making that argument, Your Honor.
Okay, well, what are you making? Because whatever colloquy occurred in the district court is really not material to how you construe this statute.
It might be, and it seems to me that you have judicial possibility of judicial estoppel.
No,
if they
you
take
don't
one
have,
position down there, and then they come up here, they're taking another.
You don't have judicial estoppel if you lost.
May I give the last two questions and answers? They're short.
Yes, sir.
Are you saying then what harm was caused by his possession of two photographs? Well, harm, as Dr. Silberg points out, is analogous to an invasion of privacy. It's a long answer. Are you saying then that the totality of the harm she has suffered from the entire abuse and the trading of pornography, that an individual defendant such as Mr. Paroline, who possessed two photographs, should be held jointly and severally liable for the entire harm? Yes, I am. So their position was that they were entitled to all of the harm from his viewing of two, or possession, excuse me, of two photographs. The stipulation, the last paragraph is important. None of the damages for which Amy is now seeking restitution flow from anyone telling her specifically about Mr. Paroline or telling her about his conduct, which was the basis of the prosecution in this case. So she was not kept aware. She did not know Paroline existed, that he had had her pictures. Yes, ma'am.
Well, let me just tell you what my concern is about your argument and about Judge Davis's opinion. Judge Davis basically took a statute the Congress intended to discourage the internet transmission and viewing of child pornography, and he basically disabled it. He rendered it a nullity as to those who view the pornographic images. And isn't that the gist of your argument?
No, ma'am, it is not.
Well, there is no other way to interpret that district court opinion.
May I?
He said the statute is unworkable. Please.
May I talk about
sure.
Judge Davis and also the judges in Burke Church and Hardy, which Hardy is cited by Amy, all carefully looked at 2259, noted the Supreme Court's opinion in Puerto Rico, Light and Power, and also a second opinion. They interpreted when several words are followed by a clause which is applicable as much to the first and other words as to the last, the natural construction of the language demands that the clause be read as applicable to all, and they said that 2259 has a proximate cause requirement. There is a problem in all restitution that we've had. You have to have the specific conduct of the defendant proximately causing a loss to an individual, and restitution is, under Huey, restitution is appropriate then.
That was under the specific language of the MVRA.
And it continues to be,
which had the direct proximate cause deal, and as Mr. Cassell points out, this has a notwithstanding provision.
Other cases have interpreted Huey to continue to apply. We suggest that Huey is still good law. I think that there is...
But it's interpreting a different statute. That's what I'm saying.
The cases which have looked at causation, Hardy, which is cited by the victim, Cutanus from the Northern District of Indiana, Woods from the Northern District of Indiana, require a causal connection between the offense of conviction and the victim's harm. All of the circuits that have done this have come to that same conclusion.
Well, you know, again, I mean, the whole upshot of your argument and the district court's argument is correct, no victim whose body has been placed in extremely offensive poses on the internet by abusers could ever recover a dime from the people who viewed that. Give me a scenario or a hypothetical where your client or a similar viewer of the image could, under your proximate cause test, ever have a restitution order.
Your Honor, I would be delighted, and it comes from the language of Judge Single in United States versus Beck, which is cited in Paroline. He was confronted with this same situation and said that if an expert had opined that Amy or Vicky would need additional monthly counseling sessions upon learning of Mr. Beck's possession, that she would be entitled to restitution. If he could show that she needed even one additional counseling session.
So in other words, the only way for her to get a restitution order out of your client is to confront your client and be told that your client in wherever he was, maybe he was in a bar, maybe he had his friends surrounding him when they all giggled together at her image. It's, in other words, to harm her is the only way she can get money. Now, clearly that nullifies the statute as to viewers of pornography because it requires causing harm to the victim.
I believe it is clear that she has to show some harm in order to be entitled to restitution.
Well, you don't doubt
that.
Well,
let me ask you this.
Which is what?
What you say then in response to what Amy says, that you are forcing her to go to each of these venues and try the case in each of these venues for maybe pennies, which she's not going to do, instead of requiring your defendant to defend himself in each of these venues. Why is that an argument that we should accept?
Your Honor, the victim has the benefit of the power of the United States government. She doesn't have to go anyplace. All she has to do is cooperate with the government in showing and in helping the government prove by preponderance of the evidence that she has been harmed by the defendant's conduct in the offense of conviction. She has ridden the government in every case. There is not a single case we're aware of where she chose to go under 18 U.S.C. 2255 and go around the country. So she doesn't have to do that.
In other words, maybe not individually, but what you are doing is forcing her to prove her case in hundreds of venues wherever her picture has appeared. I mean, which again, as Judge Jones has indicated, eviscerates the statute. She's not going to do that. She can't do that. The burden is too great for her to do that. But if she gets a single judgment against your man, then he knows where the deep pockets are and he can go find them himself. Why not put the burden on him?
If it please the court, a victim in any of these cases has two options: civil under 18 U.S.C. 2255, criminal asking the government's help under 2259. There has been, under Huey, the concept that you have to tie the restitution to the offense of conviction. We raised an Eighth Amendment question on cruel and unusual, or excuse me, on excessive fines and forfeitures, and restitution comes under that. And if this court were to award the $3+ million as restitution in this case, we would clearly have an Eighth Amendment concern about that. For an individual having, I'm sorry?
You might. I'm not sure if the Supreme Court would, but.
Well, no, I think it's not a frivolous argument. I mean, I think the Eighth Amendment is not a frivolous argument. But also, I think that what I can agree with what the suggestion of Judge Jones and Amy, that if we accept your position, it essentially eviscerates any hope of damages in 99% of the cases.
But may I add? There are some substantial restitution orders awarded in her behalf, aren't there?
There are, and they cause me considerable concern as to whether the court has followed the law.
Well, but you can be all, I mean, I'm sure they feel the other way. And the only point I'm making about that is that your interpretation of the statute is undoubtedly not the definitive one, and that's why I was somewhat concerned about the status of any appeals that are pending.
You have one case which is still to be determined, and that is in Hardy, which is cited. You have the red lights off, and I'll sit down.
I want one more question.
We gave him extra time, so we're giving you extra time.
Mr. Files, I presume that you are not objecting or arguing that Amy Unknown is a victim here in this particular case.
Because of the court's decisions in Ferber and Norris, there is no way we can make that argument.
Wonderful. The only question, to me there's two questions here. If she's a victim, she's been harmed. Then the next question, it seems to me, is what are the losses? And everybody's been talking about the losses being a proximate cause. And the question is whether that is the connection necessary, because it seems to me anyways that the proximate cause, although I understand the proximate result in definition 3C is there. Generally speaking, in a plaintiff's case, you are the negligence is a proximate cause of the injuries, the harm, okay? And then from that harm, certain damages flow. Now, you seem to be arguing that from the harm of viewing, one cannot say that $3.1 million flow from this particular harm here. Is that what you're suggesting?
I'm saying that there is a burden on the government to prove by preponderance of the evidence a loss caused by the defendant's conduct in the offense of conviction, and that they have not come close to showing any such loss.
See, and that to me is a major, major problem, it seems to me, in this particular, what your best argument is that as a proximate result of the offense, losses suffered by the victim as a proximate result of the offense. And if that takes in the entire subsection 3, the definitions that of what losses include, you may have an argument. But something is clearly wrong here because of the nature of this particular case, which is a criminal case. This is kind of an odd bird, and I just
let me ask you along those lines.
Yes, sir.
When Judge Jones suggested that there have been numerous or several awards in favor of Amy,
dozens,
were any of those recoveries based upon the theory of proximate cause that you argue?
I do not believe that they were, Your Honor. I think this is something that is basically ignored in these decisions. Or you have this series of sort of, they start in California, where they go over and look at 2255 and say it's 150 as a minimum, but we're going to give 3,000 or we're going to give 5,000. And they don't talk in terms of proximate cause. There's an absence of the term proximate cause.
What has been the general range of the awards in these verdicts? I mean, without being specific and without nailing you down at all.
Your Honor, they go from the moon at three plus million, 48,000, 64,000, $2,851, $31.80. They're across the board.
A lot of those might have been based on proximate cause. I mean, they're so limited.
They were. The 3180 and the 100 was to a victim's rights. Those were based on proximate causation tests.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right, sir. Thank you. Mr. Cassell.
Your Honor, to make clear, we were asking for one bite at the apple. We filed both mandamus and appeal because we wanted one clear review of a legal question, how to interpret this statute.
Yeah, but that goes to the argument of intent of Congress, is that it's difficult to conceive that Congress would give you both the right of appeal and mandamus with respect to the same judgment. That just doesn't happen.
Well, it's happening in this circuit only because you, with all due respect to your honors, are not following the will of Congress.
Talking about generally speaking.
Right.
Procedurally, one does not have the double overlapping right to mandamus and appeal in the same case, or it's not exercised.
Well, in the Second and the Ninth Circuit, we would file a mandamus petition, and those courts would review whether the district judge made a legal mistake.
It's absolutely clear, but you know, as far as I'm concerned, it's very arguable the district court made a clear and indisputable error of law, which we could review as a panel. Well, I mean, because the district court basically said that there was no right of a victim to restitution in the case of a viewer.
In a mandatory statute.
I mean, saying it's unworkable means I disagree with Congress and I'm not going to make it work. I mean, that's
Mr. Cassell, let me. I just want to make sure that I understand your position. It's clear that everybody concedes that Amy is a victim. It's also clear that under B1, a victim is entitled to the full amount of the victim's losses. Okay?
Yes.
I mean, that's what you're arguing.
Yes.
Now, how do you get around that 3F that says that the losses suffered by the victim as a proximate result of the offense? How do you define that to?
We have two arguments, Your Honor. The first is that's only subsection F. The $3.3 million is sought under subsections A and D. which don't have the same limiting language. If Congress wanted to limit counseling expenses, they would have put it in there as well.
Let's assume that you're wrong because of the and, the conjunction on there, and it's just, it includes them all. Let's assume
right.
you're wrong.
All right. If I'm wrong on that argument, then we our fallback position is, what do we mean then by proximate result? That's the standard. If 10 polluters dump something into a river, they're jointly and severally liable. Mr. Paroline is dumping toxic child pornography.
For instance, one could easily envision a situation where, with another type of person, where the victim had been abused sexually as a child and then because of that had gone on to be a prostitute. And that, you know, other yes. kinds of sexual indiscretions are often a consequence yes. of early childhood abuse. So then as a prostitute, the person would have been deliberately exposing her body to abuse and exploitation, and therefore you could not say that all the damages as a result of the original abuse necessarily flowed from the later self-exploitation.
I mean, that's why subsection F has this limit on it. It's got a potential to sweep in other things. That's why Congress put that proximate result limitation there. But for out-of-pocket losses like medical expenses, they just said, well, fine, the victim gets the whole thing. Judge Garza, if you're interested in the proximate cause issue, I would direct your attention to Judge Kessler's decision in United States versus Munsell, just decided about 2 weeks ago, has a very lengthy discussion of how to interpret proximate harm. And she goes through restatement of torts and a variety of things.
If it is the tort model, the tort
yes.
model,
yeah.
it's the proximate cause to the injuries, to the harm.
Yes.
And then, once you have the harm, whatever flows from that harm, whatever, quote, losses, or in the tort language, whatever damages flow, if you have that statutorily recoverable amount, then it just flows. That's you don't go through the proximate causation once harm is proved.
And remember, there is a district court finding, not challenged, of harm here.
That's exactly right. That's why, I mean, this is a little bit on the, well.
The way we see it is a variety of acts came together to produce a single harm, millions of dollars in losses to Amy. And it's not her job to disentangle all of those different events, remembering that the harm here is within the scope of the danger that made child pornography criminalized in the first place.
And it specifically incorporates under enforcement 3664, which I guess under H has that contribution language.
Now let me ask, how do you get around the Huey case?
Huey is just a case involving the Victim Witness Protection Act.
That's
it's a
different statute. And that required
right.
the direct connection between the particular offense,
right.
my panel got reversed in that case, between the offense of conviction and the loss.
And so here Congress said, well, notwithstanding that, 99% of the cases the other side has cited in their briefs on proximate cause come from other statutes that have that language right in it. It's not applicable here. We have a different
offense of conviction.
Right. And to be a victim under those statutes, you have to be, quote, directly and proximately harmed. Here Congress said, well, that's not going to work. We're going to write a statute that's much broader. Well, if I can make just one last point, we do have pending our petition for rehearing en banc. We think the jurisdictional issues all go away if the Fifth Circuit reverses en banc Dean and follows what is the majority view in other circuits. The legislative history is overwhelming that Congress wanted the courts to broadly defend victims' rights at the appellate level. And the Dean decision doesn't even look at that legislative history, so that would be another way to clean up the mess and, frankly, to protect the rights of crime victims throughout the Fifth Circuit in many other cases.
Can we rule in your favor, I mean, in terms of jurisdiction of, in terms of standing of Amy in this appeal in the face of Dean?
Yes, you could do.
Can we do that now?
There are a couple of ways to do that. Judge Dennis ruled in our favor, and we have a petition for panel rehearing. He said this is clearly and indisputably wrong. That would be the simplest way to reverse the district court without getting into the mandamus standard
still,
of review.
I mean, Dean is standing out there. I mean,
right.
We would not reach the question of the appeal here.
Right. If you simply said, as Judge Dennis has already said, this is clearly and indisputably wrong. There's now been full merits briefing. At the time of the mandamus petition, of course, they were just briefs that had been filed within 72 hours.
We as a panel could not say that Amy has standing under the appeal. Under the appeal.
You wouldn't have to, if you want to go that route, if you want. You could avoid the, yes, you could, Your Honor. You could simply, we have two vehicles in front of you right now. We have our mandamus petition, which you could pick up and say.
You could avoid the question.
Yes, exactly. Yes, avoid it, I'm sorry.
Overrule.
Right, correct. You could avoid the whole appellate issue by saying we take Amy's mandamus petition and we find the district judge clearly and indisputably erred now that there's been full merits briefing and a full chance for oral argument from Amy and the other side. And then that would take care of the problem.
All right.
All right.
Thank you very
much. Thank you, Your Honor.
We thank both sides for your helpful arguments.